morning, everyone. I'll reconvene the hearing. Before we continue with questions of Mr. Bryce, Mr. Goldsmith tells us that he wishes to briefly address us.
Thank you, sir. Commissioners. Having read the schedule for next week allows 2.5 hours for myself and my two planners. And the following day, almost equal length of time for Ms. Baker Galloway and Ms. Toos. Having read the opening submissions for council, in particular paragraphs 5.24 and 5.25, where the council, from notified conceded or changed its position from fully discretionary to RDA, and in those two paragraphs, has courts to accept submissions or evidence that council discretionary control over lot size should be removed. Now, if that concession is accepted by the panel, and I fully accept that's the panel's decision, not the council's, that deals with 90% of the concerns of my clients that I'll be appearing for. And I'm reluctant to spend waste your time and mine flogging a dead horse if in fact a particular horse is dead, which I don't know yet. So I'm just alerting you to that fact and basically saying that when I turn up on Monday, the council doesn't want to hear any more on the issue of whether council should have discretionary control over lot size in zones where there is a minimum lot size specified, so residential, rural lifestyle, rural residential, those three standard zones, then I wouldn't intend to address that any further and would be, in terms of my case, be left with almost remainder control versus RDA debate issue and a couple of brief minor ones. And I can't see it taking 2040 minutes. Secondly, you will have seen one set of submissions from me and two briefs of evidence covering similar issues. Subject to your direction, I would propose probably hot tubbing those two, Mr. Brown and Mr. Farrell, who will be here together. And if we deal with them one at a time, one's going to sit there and listen to the questions that are going to come. So I'm entirely in your hands, but it may prove more time efficient for me to present, to say whatever I have to say, and then have the two planners there, and they can both answer any questions from the panel. Likewise, as part of that, commissioners, I anticipate Mr. Ferguson is going to come along on the Monday to listen to the questions to Mr. Brown and Mr. Farrell. And Ms. Baker Galloway will be probably be available on a call. So, if in fact my 2 hours 40 collapses significantly, there may even be scope to bring Tuesday morning's hearing forward into Monday afternoon, if you wanted to. I'm just spending between us, there's 4 hours, between myself and Ms. Baker Galloway, there's 4 hours there. And with what's now left, I just can't see it coming close to that.
Maybe you can confer with my colleagues if that.
I'm mostly going to answer now, so I'm just alerting to the fact that I'll turn on Monday and
yes.
Put plan as you see fit. And the other thing is, Commissioner, is that one minor issue right at the end of my submissions, which is the issue of in the rural lifestyle zone, whether the minimum is 1 hectare or 2 hectares, which is another debate, that the rule should be, if it was one, say, the rule should be minimum 1 hectare average, not minimum 1 hectare. And in my submissions at the re-end, I refer to a plan, a subdivision that was with the question, why should this plan be non-compliant? Because of that particular issue. Now, that is a district-wide issue. It's a rural lifestyle zone issue, and I apologise for not realising we've gone back through the minutes that having read the opening submission, but it was a district-wide issue to be carried forward. You asked for a prior warning. It's a minor issue. It is a district-wide issue. I don't think the panel would otherwise deal with it, and I just alert you to that fact in case the panel might want to ask Mr. Bryce perhaps before next Monday to use a small supplementary opinion on that particular issue. And if you read my submissions, commissioners, the submission as lodged was that it should be a controlled activity regime, minimum 1 hectare average. Mr. Farrell recommends control for minimum 1 hectare and RDA for 1 hectare average, and I'm highly comfortable with that alternative. So it isn't a huge issue, but it needs to be dealt with sometime. You may wish to ask Mr. Bryce to produce something over the next couple of days for you to consider before Monday.
Well,
I
will confer with my colleagues, particularly on the matter of the first issue you raised, as to how, whether we respond to that now, because that clearly makes a difference to timing. But we would still like to hear your arguments, your submissions on that point. We haven't finished questioning Mr. Bryce yet, and we don't know fully in their own minds where we'd get to on that position of his. We've got to start, of course, with the notified claim and work from there. Notwithstanding that the council itself may have changed its position.
I understand that, sir. Okay. And if I can signal, I took some effort to put it all down in writing, so you're not going to be hearing much more from me than you might see in the written submission down in the evidence.
I mean, if we end up the period allotted for you is too much, then we will have it early lunch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I do, Mr. Chair. Just one procedural matter. I have confirmed instructions in relation to the suggestion by Mr. Wells that the Authority of Checks and Policies and Rules relating to Jack Zone be deferred.
Yes.
The Council's position is that it doesn't agree with that suggestion, so it continues to support the position as set out in our written opening, which is that they should not be deferred. The evidence has been filed by Mr. Wells on that, and it is before you. He does say in his evidence that he's reasonably happy with where the council's got to in Section 42A, and he does suggest some further tinkering, I think he calls it, which Mr. Bryce has responded to. So the council is comfortable that the issues have been responded to in this hearing, and that it can continue
forward on that. continue using the early version, I've got the other version on my iPad, so if there's a number of issues, as there was yesterday, I can check it quickly.
That's fine. I'm just taking notes to that section.
The next query I have is under the stormwater section of policies, which is 27.2, 5, 12 and 13. I was wondering whether there should be a policy seeking minimisation of off-site stormwater flows above pre-development levels. I think that was in effect sought in relation to Kiramoka in the 100-year thing. The plan seems to be silent on how to deal with stormwater. And that seems
Yes, I do agree with you. I think it could be nourishment, actually grading.
I suppose the following question, the question that follows from that is whether the policies are purely aimed at the urban development or do they are more encompassing?
I think the intent is that they are all encompassing.
They do seem to be okay practice, but piping, they don't they?
Yes, you could look at it that way. So,
I just wonder if that submission related to Kiramoka might provide some scope to.
So as you expand that into a policy?
Yes, I'm a bit concerned that certainly in rural living zones, those don't really appear to provide for the sort of stormwater management system that you want in those zones.
Greater emphasis on non-reticulated areas and stormwater management.
Yes.
Right, you're saying.
I think that's
stormwater.
Yes.
Looking at your suggested revisions 27.2.5.13, I have two issues to explore with you. The first is in the last line, are the words are acceptable, indeed acceptable, in the absence of some indication as to the criteria that the council might employ to decide that question. And the second point is that I read Mr. Wallace's evidence that he would also have an additional test whether the proposed jointly provided open space recreational opportunities were in fact useful, and I'm wondering whether that should be added as an additional criterion in this policy, given the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think we could be nourishing actually providing a number of matters of guidance as to the acceptability of what the council would term acceptable. The result being this type of stormwater response.
And accepting you'll think about it, can you give us any indication off the cuff?
I think I'd have to talk to about that.
That's understood, thank you.
I mean, the those matters are, there will be a history there that that we can probably use to guide that policy in terms of how the council has dealt with those issues in the past.
Yes, I think Mr. Wallace's evidence was that it would be, are the costs reasonable, which of course raises a whole series of issues in itself as to what the test of reasonableness might be, but if you could think about that and come back to us.
Yes, that's fine.
So turning to the next policy, 514, you say at the end, avoids or mitigates adverse effects. Is that really what is intended? Because that essentially is pretty broad.
Chase, we went we had a discussion with a number of the planning witnesses in the Stream 1B hearing who wanted to put mitigation as an option, and I think the common thread when we discussed it with them was that to add mitigation you need some guidance as to the extent of mitigation, whether it's a lot or a little.
I suppose the question is whether you're trying to minimise the effects if you can't avoid them, or is it just any form of mitigation is okay?
Well, I think that if you can't avoid it, you've probably got no other option other to minimise, well, mitigate.
Perhaps the benefit was to say that. The higher level policies that use that phraseology, avoid or where not practical to avoid, then mitigate or minimise. I think that without that option, the default position will be mitigate, won't it?
Yes.
Thinking about there's probably something in the proposed rural regional policy statement that would have to give effect to, given that it's a regional matter. That might give you some wording guidance. So now, turning now to the next section, 2517. The energy supply and telecommunications. In little two, that's requiring reticulated appropriate alluvial amenity values, do you consider the landscape values relevant?
Yes, they're clearly a relevant consideration in this district.
Follow up on that one. This was something I obtained on your report, Mr. Bryce. Is this another example of a urban-rural interface? Would telecommunication and electricity supply in the rural environment generally be underground?
Not based on my experience.
Yes, well, I have seen a lot of power poles around the place in the rural environment. So, but that's a question.
Mm-hmm.
Does there need to be some differentiation between the urban and rural environment, and does there need to be some greater specificity as to when services should be underground in the rural environment? I might bring you back full circle to the chair's question.
Following on from that, and this again I think is part of the problem of the policy being written for the urban subdivision, and not necessarily for rural, but in Roman 4 in the same policy, it talks about requiring connections to the lot. Is it relevant to get them to residential building platforms in rural areas, because getting to the boundary of the lot is quite a different matter from...
Yes, it is, but from my experience, typically when dealing with subdivision, a subdivision, we're not creating a residential building platform, it's typically to the lot. But I do agree with you, dealing with situations like the rural general zone where typically you have to specify where a residential building platform is. It does make sense to look at that.
Because certainly the access is not that to the residential building platform. It would be logical to look at the reticulation to it at the same time. And this policy suggests that that is unnecessary, but possibly be used for the council's disadvantage.
So, and
it may be that what's needed is a second policy that deals with the rural situation rather than in addition to the urban.
It would typically apply to the rural zone, gives the character, and the rural lifestyle zone,
yes.
All of which require residential building platforms.
And the other matters would also be relevant to rural residential with overhead or effect on night lights, night sky, etc. Also relevant there too.
Just on that point, sir, what I'll do is look at expanding that point, but I'll also look at how that practice is actually implemented through the consent process. just to ensure that it's consistent with that.
I'm next with the very last one, 227.2.5.19. Ensure that easements are of appropriate size, location and length for the intended use. Is that the intended use of the land or the intended use of the easement, or both?
Probably both.
Maybe you should say that.
My next question is on the Esplanade Reserve matters. And looking at policy 271, that appears to provide the optional circumstance where a council may choose to take an Esplanade Reserve if it's over. The lots are over 4 hectares. There seems to be no policy as to the situation where it's obligatory and the size, etc., of Esplanade Reserves where it's under 4 hectare lots created. I might be misreading that, but it's just.
For you questioning whether or not there should be a policy that provides guidance for the creation of Esplanade Reserves where they are below, or for lots created which are below the specified
minimum. Yes. I mean, section 230, isn't it, that requires Esplanade Reserves in those circumstances. But the decision maker needs guidance as to how to deal with requests to waive the requirement or reduce the size of them,
yes,
and without any policy direction. And I'm not sure that that policy gives that, because it just says that we'll encourage Esplanade Reserves and that will, and where that will not put an inappropriate burden on the council. It seems to me that that's suggesting that in those circumstances you can avoid Esplanade Reserves. I don't know that that's the intention.
No, I don't think it is the intention of the policy, no.
Maybe that would be an example of a situation where a waiver wouldn't be sought.
I think I'll have to look at that and come back to you in my reply.
Well, and the other thing, the other question I had on that is, well, there are two other questions. The first is, there seems to be no policy as to when the council will prefer to take Esplanade strips over Esplanade Reserves. That's left totally unanswered.
Yes.
And the seems to be no, other than that 7.1, there's no clear policy as to those special circumstances in the district where the council may choose to take esplanade reserves or esplanade strips on large development, on large lots. I'm sure you've seen some of the policies in other district plans. That seems to be an omission as well. It may be an intentional omission. The council may not intend to do it, but I think that needs to be answered. Where our head is on the issue of boundary adjustments. I've already discussed with you the issue of amalgamation, so I won't go through that again. But with policy 281, we had in the rural hearing stream a number of submissions that there should be the ability to subdivide, to unit title or somehow create separate ownership of residential building platforms, or was more along the lines of there should be able to have more than one residential unit on a residential building platform. But we won't subdivide the site again, but this policy seems to imply that a cross lease or a unit title of those two units would be possible, and I don't think that is intended either.
No.
Am I right in reading the policy that it's actually directed at urban development rather than being dependent on the rural areas?
That's right. So I think given the concerns raised about the potential to subdivide building platforms, there needs to be either that policy or a new policy needs to be introduced to cover that matter off.
Yeah.
I'm certainly in favour of the policy and why it's worded, but it could be used against the council for partly subsequent reasons of voting for things.
The other thing about that policy, does it also apply to commercial and industrial land? Or is it only residential units?
Well, it's not specified, is it?
No.
It could actually be.
I mean, I can see that in an urban environment, that policy is 100% appropriate. And maybe that's what the policy needs to be explicit in that sense.
Depending on the term urban environment, just so I'm clear, so you would be happy for that the policy to be made clearer for the purpose of plan administration and plan users?
Yes, it was specifically for the urban zones.
Yeah, that's right.
And that may require a definition of what urban zones are.
Yes, as you'll see in the rules that I've restricted discretionary activity rule, I did struggle with how to integrate that response for the rule framework.
While you're thinking about that, I seem to recall reading those rules and thinking, because you defined it with respect to the UGBs, where that left the rural townships.
Yes, and that's what that we'll raise when we get to the rule. We have talked about it. There is an anomaly there where you are dealing with the township, but also those zones, the low density residential zones that are actually specified in the plan that are included within an urban growth boundary and derivation one.
That's what we make haste.
Correct.
Yes.
Yes.
That might be resolved in time.
Yes. But there is a way around it, which I've thought about, so we can talk about that.
Okay. Any other
we jump a few pages. Policy 37332, which is in the flat block residential zones, but I'm no area.
Sure, okay.
And it refers in there to land identified as urban landscape protection by the Wanaka Structure Plan 2007. Has the Wanaka Structure Plan been incorporated into the district plan by reference?
I'll have to look at that on the computer to see clarification about that. I can't recall seeing it in the list of documents referred.
And I'm wondering, given that you have recommended controlled activity to subdivision in areas identified as a structure plan, there's potentially confusion being created by reference to the Wanaka Structure Plan in this, because it's actually a different type of beast from what you're intending on the other aspect. It might be easier just to show this on the maps or something.
I'm just recalling this, so it does appear that it is
right.
But it doesn't appear that it's in that list of recent documents, so yeah, that makes it possibly problematic. Mm. I'm just wondering, I'll have to check, but I have actually looked at the Kurumoko land on...
This isn't Kurumoko, this is the next area, which is the large lot land.
Oh, sorry.
Between Stunham and Meadowstone Drive.
Oh, sorry, it's policy 37332.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Yes. Forgot that. sorry. Yes, I would need to have a look at, I don't think the zones plan refers to any boundary.
No.
Landscape boundary line or anything like that.
I mean, I know that there are submissions seeking that the large lot zone have a smaller minimum lot size everywhere, which would make it consistent with that applied in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be that in the long term that changes, but I still think that if there's a particular rationale, it's a way of identifying it, it might need to be better defined than the way it's been done.
Yes, I think, I suspect it's probably through design, changes to design maps to mitigate some sort of line. As it would certainly make it clearer for pan users and overcome the problematic issue of the climate destruction plan not being included as reference.
And then try to find it 15 years time.
Yeah. That also comes back to the discussion we had yesterday about what is a structure plan for the purposes of that controlled activity rule.
Mm-hmm.
You might care to bear the existence of this beast in mind when pondering how that could be defined.
Yes, well, certainly the Monitor Structure Plan 2007 is essentially a non-statutory, my understanding, non-statutory structure plan, but not in the context of a structure plan to apply to the zone, but very different and a very high level strategic document for the future growth of Wanaka. Whereas the documents we're talking about that apply to a zone are site-specific responses to the rationale behind the development subdivision of that land.
The rural stream hearings, we heard evidence that in fact all the subdivision consents have been granted now for that subzone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering to what extent that policy is now of any relevance. Consider that in the context of the consent being granted.
Yes. It may still be relevant, but it would obviously be applying at the broader subdivision of that that area.
Mm.
May be applicable to scenarios that involve subdivision.
Mm.
I don't think you can discount no further subdivision in that area.
No.
But I'll think about how that.
Well, it should be drafted in terms of present environment going forward rather than when it was inserted into the Oxford plan some years ago, which is, I suspect, where that policy has come from.
I don't know. Exactly that, yes.
Mm. Chapter 22, and this really is a general question whether, in your view, all of these structure plans should actually be in this chapter in one place. I raised this with Ms. Scott yesterday. And if that...
Well, in my section 42A, I do refer to them being in the subdivision chapter, but I mean, I don't necessarily see that there's a need for them to be integrated in the subdivision chapter if the policy and rule framework are sufficiently interconnected. And by way of example, there are a number of structure plans that are not under the operative plan that are referred to in the zone specific provisions that aren't integrated in the subdivision, the operative subdivision chapter. I think that the mechanics of the subdivision chapter are easy to understand, providing you've got that connection between the policy and the rules and the zone specific chapters.
I think it might be useful and helpful for us if, in your reply, just consider whether the information contained in that concept development plan is directly related to the land use rules in Chapter 22 or the subdivision rules under Chapter 27, because I think that's probably the determinant as to where they go.
And that's just in relation to the period you're
moving to? Well, it's the one that's referred to here, but I probably the approach to take on all the support.
Yes, okay. Well, certainly in relation to the zones such as Jack's Point, for example, a lot of the rules link back to the structure plan in that chapter and are very detailed.
Yes.
You wouldn't necessarily want to, I don't think it'd be need to pull through the Jack's Point structure plan into the subdivision chapter.
No, but that is sub areas where there are different rules applied.
Yes,
of being used. I suspect that theory holds in some of that from memory isn't quite the same.
Yeah, okay, well, I'll have a look at that.
Then the reference is wrong.
It is. But in saying that, it should actually be, I think the intent is to cross-reference back to Chapter 22, but it can also refer to the structure plan at page, and this is the version that we're looking at, so it'll be page 27/53.
Well, I think, yes.
I just had to check.
I suspect that rather than a page number, it might be better to have an appendix for Chapter 27 or something like that, because the page numbers will be changing every time we make an alteration.
Correct. Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
Yes.
So, any extra to Chapter 27?
Policy 371, which relates to the Wayuna Station rural lifestyle zone. So 3 under there, but the zone can be serviced, etc. Do you know if this is a new provision or is it in the operative district plan?
I'm pretty sure it's carried through from the operative plan, and I can confirm that.
If it's been carried through from the operative district plan, is the effect of that to give someone second bite opportunity or something? Because the intention was they did something within 2 years of becoming operative, and now the policy says again, when this plan is made operative, they've got another 2 years. Is that what the council intends?
Certainly don't think that's the intention, the council's intention here. To have multiple bites of the cherry, so to speak.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know anything about the circumstances of that subzone, but it doesn't seem logical to me.
I'll do a bit of further research on that. And confirm back in my writing reply,
okay,
just to ensure that there isn't anything untoward there.
I'll just note that in objective 2739 and 27310 and the policies under them, I've just struck those out to be deleted. Is that what the council intends? Because those are for stage two.
Yes, they are. Yes. I think they were. Essentially, they were part of an O5 plan, and I haven't struck them out here, just for the purposes of numbering figures.
Is it intended that they remain as placeholders in that position, or they increase in between a series of special zones, or should?
No, it was never the intention that they form part of the my understanding, it was never the intention to carry through the stage two zones,
right?
Like what we have. So, and this is an issue to do with them being struck out in the issues.
Right. Okay.
I have a question about that. Did any coming submitter seek to change those objectives and policies?
No. I think the submitter's got the meters that it was a bit of a waste of time submitting on stage two provisions.
Now the provisions relating to Jack's point, and I realise these have probably been copied from the operative plan.
Yes.
I have a number of concerns with the objective in particular, which talks about subdivisions will have regard to identified location-specific opportunities and constraints. What does that mean?
Well, I think the intent is to probably link back to the opportunities and constraints that are actually identified in the structural plan.
Opportunities and constraints. Is that a policy to do that?
that it's worded, it still reads like an outcome statement.
Mm. But it doesn't tell us what the outcome is. It doesn't tell us what the outcome is because we don't know what the unified location specific duties and constraints are.
That's right. So, but again, that I think the intent is that those opportunities, i.e. the development opportunities and the constraints, the landscape and areas of open space, are obviously identified in the Jack's Point structure plan.
Should the intent be expanded to make that understandable?
I think that would be clearer for anyone reading the plan. And certainly wouldn't have any concerns about integrating the reference to the structure plan and the policy and the objective.
Mm. See that policy 13.1 refers to the objectives and policies in the Jack's Point zone, and maybe the objective would equally somehow relate. There may be objectives that it could relate to there to make it clearer to what the outcome is that's sought to assist. The other area I have is the 13.3, the last policy. Is that a policy? Is that an assessment criteria?
Well, that's an issue that's been raised by submitters in the evidence, that some of these introduced policies do read like assessment matters.
Although, I think that's been rolled over from the Oxford plan too, hasn't it?
Well, this 27.3.13.3 has been introduced as a consequential amendment.
Right.
Well, I suppose my question is, what is the course of action that's going to be followed here?
Well, the intent of the policy is to ensure that the matters of control listed under Rule 27.6 are adhered to. So the outcome is the policy seeks to guide planned users as to that outcome.
What's the course of action if they don't achieve the matters of control listed?
From there to the activity status listed under that rule framework.
Would it be the right idea if the policy said that?
Well, it's even more complicated than that, because the first matter of control that's listed is the extent to which the subject is consistent with the relevant location specific objective and policy.
Mm-hmm.
But that's circular.
Yeah. So a way, I'll just take a look at those. Just looking at the the intent. So the Jack's Point structure zone, structure plan, there's specific provisions listed under 27, rule 27.7.4. So first of all, there's an error in this policy because it refers to rule 27.6.1. So it should actually refer to 27, in the first instance, it should actually refer to the structure plan rule fund, which is embedded under 27.7. So in terms of this policy, I think it will probably be clearer if that policy was to link to 27.7.1 and 27.7.4, which is the Jack's Point specific rule framework.
Well, isn't there an element of doubling up there, because you look at 27.7.1, the matters of control are the general matters of control which the earlier objectives and policies have already dealt with.
Yes.
So, is it necessary for this policy to require again the consideration of those?
No, it doesn't. So,
and the second question is looking at 27.7.4. While they are quite detailed, would it be helpful if the relevant points out of that were included in this policy so that the policy would be that the subdivision achieves, for example, the provision of public access rights, etc.
Yeah.
So the policy sets out with bullet points, yes. Although there'll be little numbers.
And that's the outcome, the intent of the policy is to
I think the policy should be explicit as to what is intended. It doesn't matter if it's repeated as well and expanded, but I suspect that policy is just waiting for challenge.
Well, it has been challenged by the...
I know, I just wouldn't suppose it's a finish.
Yes. I think that a common sense approach would reflect good resource management practice.
That the roles flow from the policies and not the other way around.
Yes. and the same applies in Whitfield Park policies.
So where I've introduced that specific policy, there needs to be a drop down and flow into the
I think, Mr. Price, you can take from us that we are prepared to ignore brevity if we can get better understanding than the policies. We're not focused on reducing the number of pages of the document.
Thank you.
ask a question on the events and policies.
And moving on to the rules, I have a general issue about how these are structured. Normally, I've seen rule packages that cascade downwards from permitted, down all the way to prohibited sometimes, but there is some internal cross-referencing to prevent a discretionary activity rule overlapping with a permitted activity rule and not knowing which apply. Mm. And I wondered whether it might be helpful if something of that ilk was put up the very front of the rule section, because there are some that do overlap, where you put, for instance, geographically specific rules, where for an activity that would otherwise or could arguably fall within a more general rule. Something for you to ponder.
Yes, I've read the planning evidence, and there are some suggestions around how to overcome some of those tensions with how some of those rules interrelate. But I do think that an explanation at the front of the rule would help.
The classic one is it's permitted unless some more onerous rule applies.
Yes.
And so on.
I'm just wondering if it's necessary to have the provision that you added at the end there. You pointed to the submission, but isn't that a requirement of the Act? You can't go to the DLR unless you've got a certificate of compliance.
Yes, I mean, it could be. I think the intent of the submitter was to draw that to our attention that you actually require a certificate of compliance.
So you
said it's a provision of the Act.
It's not a standard of. It's not a standard. It's not a term that has to be achieved.
No.
To be a permitted activity, so maybe better to be as an advice note.
Oh yes, I think so. That would be. Yeah. I think it would be helpful. I think the intent of this event was to draw to our attention that this process actually, I mean, it's a process outcome. Yeah. Has to be achieved before you can actually get permitted. So the advice note sitting below that.
Yes, I think within the same box. I just think it should be clear that it's not a standard or term for the permitted activity.
Bryce, going to 27.5.3, I have sort of two interrelated questions here. The first is the first proviso, the building platform is retained in its approved location. Do we need to provide for the situation where there is no building platform currently, And at a much more general level, this and a subsequent rule prompted me to go looking for the objectives and policies governing building platforms, what they are, where they are, why they are, and I was utterly unable to find any guidance. Can you point me to the policy underpinning for the building platform provisions and this and the subsequent rules?
Well, there is rules in here that talk about the size, scale of the building platform.
Yes, I know. I did a word search looking for where building platform was mentioned, because it's all over the rules.
It's not integrated in the policy. I think
perhaps that's a wider question. I prefer that we deal with that later, because I've got some questions on that specifically.
Let's deal with the specific question. Well, the specific question in the context of this rule is, would it be a good idea if, rather than saying the building platform is retained, it said no new building platform is created?
Yes. Yes, I'm pretty sure that there is a similar word to that effect in the operative plan under the controlled activity boundary adjustment provisions relating to the rural dune zone. I've got it right in front of me, so I said it.
That would defer the exciting discussion what a building platform is.
So just to confirm, there is a, so just so we're clear about the reference, you can have a look if you need to at some stage. 15, this is the operative subdivision chapter, rule 15.2.3.2, controlled activity, subdivision activities, clause B, Roman numeral IC, no new residential building platform should be identified and approved as part of the boundary adjustment. So, in relation to those zones that require building platforms, I think it would be consistent with that operative rule framework to include that.
And it might be an addition. Addition rather than, I was thinking about substituting, but maybe one should be remain, but just say any building platform is retained in its current approved location.
And if I can expand on the operative rule, it says any approved residential building platform must be retained in its approved location.
Snap.
So.
Is that you can adjust the boundary and amalgamate with another lot. somewhere else, it'd still be a boundary adjustment that I think we need to help.
As per your example.
Just across the page, I just wonder if there's a typo or something in it. Says the boundary adjustments are narrow down to the growth boundary and on the site that contains a heritage or any other protected item or schedule in the district.
In the district plan?
Well, should be all, or is it in a finished schedule, or is it someone has a copy of the schedule at home and then they're called by it?
Yeah, the district plan.
Boundary adjustments within an urban growth boundary and on a site that contains a heritage item.
Or any other protected item.
Yes.
Or any other item protected in the district plan is probably not a major source.
That's correct, yes, the district plan.
So just for my benefit, so the intention is that these are sites within Arrowtown?
Correct. But it needed to be quite specific to the urban growth boundary.
But this is also the sites that are not in Arrowtown that have a heritage of a particular.
Yes, that was where I was coming from.
Yes, yes, so it's got a dual,
right,
dual intent.
So maybe, yes, you might want to look at the grammar of that to make sure that's expressive.
Yes, okay.
Drafting suggestion, reverse them. Say, on sites containing etc., and in the case of Arrowtown, within the UB or GB.
Yes, yeah, that
would make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the next question is a more general one. We have a situation where a land use consent has been granted for a multi-unit development, whether vertical or horizontal, and unit title across each subdivision is proposed. Why is that not, and it's in accordance with the land use consent, why is that not a control activity identified?
The boundary's not going to be going anywhere, they're following the individual unit structure.
But the unit title plan, you have to stick to the building that's consented. There's given the intention, as I understand it, is to enable more residential development in urban areas, it's quite an important issue.
It is. I think it's an oversight on my part. And I think that clearly, from a fixed space point of view, it should be captured by an RDA framework. Because the building's there, the land use is there, the units are there. So I can include a rule to that effect.
I think that would be consistent with that policy we discussed earlier, too, about multi-unit developments. But it probably also needs to be specific to within urban areas. Because it equally applies to commercial and industrial properties that might want to have unit title subdivisions or long-term leases, company act subdivisions.
So the intent of the rule, is it linked specifically to a land use that has been constructed? I mean, in terms of the intent.
Under the Unit Titles Act, you have to have, before you can get your titles issued for the principal unit, there has to be a building. And I think if you look at what is done in some other districts, they usually say to the point the roof is on, and then the subdivision can proceed. And I thought there used to be something about that on here, but I couldn't find it.
There are provisions relating to
not that I'm an expert on unit title say way any streets of maturation, but is that that restriction to have a building, is that for horizontal titles? For vertical titles,
horizontal and vertical.
Right.
No, because the principal unit has to be in relation to the boundaries of it, has to be in relation to the building.
If I can just clarify, if we turn to page 27, 22, it's rule 27.5.18. That's dealing with a scenario where
it's not complete.
Exactly. So we need to actually...
When it is complete, it could be controlled. You shouldn't have really restricted discretion in activity because you already had to get your consent for your land use, which would have dealt with all the effects of the building.
Correct.
Yes. I'm understanding this, but a very difficult unit title subdivision that I'm trying to repair that was done pre-1991 with no council consent wasn't put in place.
There's no sort of compliance under the building code.
I'm not even sure the building consent's working.
Well, there's all sorts of tricky histories that you get involved with.
Yes. So I think that also may somewhat assuage the concerns of everything being restricted discretionary.
Correct, yes. Yeah, I think that it is an oversight on my part. I'll just go back through and just check to see, I'll do a search on unit title provisions under these submissions to see what fleshes out, but I'm almost certain there will be something that seeks to give that easy.
Now, you've already alluded to the issue of the next rule, which I had highlighted in 27.5.5, the low density residential zones. What about when it's not in the living growth boundary? I'm hopeful that the instance that you identified in the Wakatipu Basin will be solved by the Wakatipu Basin planning study, even if it only comes to drawing a living growth boundary around those 10 sites.
So just on that matter, I was thinking about that a way around addressing that anomaly that was identified was that you could actually include a new 10, number 10, to that rule that essentially deals with any of the above zones that are not otherwise identified within an urban growth boundary, the rule shall apply. But the intent is that subdivision within those zones are captured by this.
But wary of that, because if we were to recommend that the urban growth boundaries remain, and the policy direction is quite explicit that any further residential or urban development be within those urban growth boundaries, and then there's a rule that says any urban land outside you can subdivide or encourage.
Well, that's existing
private plan changes without urban growth boundary changes.
Yes.
But you might like to pass the comments, pass that issue on to the council to consider in the Botanical Basin study. I suspect that that piece of zoning is an oversight in terms of the urban growth boundaries when they draft them.
This is you're talking about the low density, vacated low density
region? Yes. Mm. Because the policies in the notified plan seem to say it shouldn't be outside the urban growth boundaries.
I think the, I mean, you could overcome it by simply referring to existing zones. Lift it up.
But existing zones become existing when private plan change gets them off that, comes into effect. That's been their existing zone.
Yes, they are. Anyway, so we're live to the issue.
Mm.
Well, I'm certainly live to the issue and discussed it with our colleagues. So it's, we've identified it and we can deal with that appropriately through right of reply.
Well, the next question I'm going to ask you is going to be about this issue of the discretionary lot sizes. So I'll give you the chance to think about that over the morning interval. We'll take the adjournment because it's going to take some time for us to go through that issue, I suspect.
Yes, yes. Well, just to foreshadow, I've looked at that issue in some detail and have a response for you on that. So.
We'll adjourn until 8:45.